Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention? I'm Rod Finkel, the president of the council, and I welcome you here today. I want to thank Will Tort again for recording our program, which will be played later on KSKA. That'll probably be early next week. For those of you interest in helping to support the council, you can also help us as volunteers for the fund drive next week, which is for KSKA, I believe. And we need people to take telephone calls. We are in partnership with them, and we support their activities, and they graciously support ours. Now I'd like to introduce our head table, and to my very far left, we have Dr. Ted Kassir, who is Director of International Affairs, joining us at the head table. Thank you, Ted, for coming. Ted is a past board member. Sitting next to him is Ira Perman, who is representing the Atwood Foundation today. They are providing the support for our speaker, and I will ask Ira to do the introduction of our guest speaker. Ira?
Thank you, Rod. Fellow members of the Alaska World Affairs Council, it's today my pleasure, my honor to introduce, or say reintroduce you to Pat Yak. Pat spoke to us last year on the subject of foreign journalism and its status. Today, Pat is back to talk to us on the topic of why do we read what we read and why do we watch what we watch. Pat is a veteran journalist. He has had a distinguished career as a reporter, editor, and now a new media strategist. He has reported from South Korea, the Soviet Union, Honduras. He has covered Congress, legislatures, the United States Navy, the 1984 presidential campaign, professional and college sports, and major regional and national news stories. His assignments have included DC Bureau Chief for the Denver Post, National Editor for the Atlantic Constitution, Managing Editor for the Eugene, Oregon Register Guard, and Editor for the Florida Times Union. A protector of our First Amendment and the Fourth Estate, Mr. Yak is a member of the Committee to Protect Journalists, an organization founded to promote press freedom and protect the rights of journalists. He is also the former co-chair of the American Society of Newspaper Editors Freedom of Information Committee, which has taken the lead national role in supporting a federal shield law defending reporters' rights and promoting greater access to government records. Not to be overlooked, Mr. Yak has served as a Pulitzer Prize juror. His wife, Suzanne, currently the acting executive director of the Alaska Community Foundation, is the former editor of the Juneau Empire, which seems to run in the family. Today, Pat is the vice president of news and public media at Alaska Pacific Telecommunications, Inc., which you know as KSKA and KAKM, and the Atwood chair at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He is also an adjunct faculty member at UAA, where he teaches courses in advanced reporting and web journalism. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Mr. Pat Yak.
Wow, thanks.
I got all dressed up today for Macon Roberts, and I'm very disappointed that Macon's not here today. The first time I met him, he was wearing a bow tie, and I said, Macon, it's so delightful to see someone who appreciated bow ties, and I said, I have an extensive collection, and every time I would run into Macon, I wouldn't have a bow tie on. So I thought, well, today I'm going to see Macon, I'm going to wear a bow tie. And yes, I did tie it myself. So if you see Macon again, tell him that it's a little tip of the hat to him today. I think most of you know that I am a Southerner, and Southerners are born, I think, to tell stories. And I thought it would be appropriate to tell a story that goes back to a number of years ago when all of us were much younger. Jimmy Carter was president, and his mother Lillian, whom some of you remember, granted an interview, and I will cloak the name of the newspaper. Let's just say it was a well-known East Coast newspaper, And so the reporter dutifully showed up on time at Mrs. Carter's house and knocked on the door. Mrs. Carter went to the door and said, "It is so good to see you." She opened the door, and she and the reporter went back into the house. And for about an hour or so, the reporter asked Mrs. Carter all sorts of questions about then, I believe, candidate Carter and the family and the business and politics and public policy and so forth. And near the end, so the story goes, he said, "Mrs. Carter, I have to ask you a question." She said, your son is telling the country that he's never told a lie. You remember that? I've never told a lie. And Mrs. Carter very gracefully leaned over and patted him on the knee and said, "Oh, he's told white lies." And the reporter looked at her and he said, "White lies? Well, what's a white lie?" She says, "Well, you know, when you came to the door and I opened it up and I said, 'It was so good to see you.'" I think it's a great story. It might even be true. I don't know. Well, I'm wearing a couple of hats today. One is the 2009 Atwood Chair at UAA, and I'm still a member of the adjunct faculty over there teaching journalism, and wrapped up a class in web journalism this past year, and be teaching that course again in the fall. And the other is the Vice President of News and Public Media at KAKM, KSKA, and the Alaska Public Radio Network. I continue to be impressed by the work being done at UAA to help prepare the next generation of journalists for the next generation of media. And I am very appreciative of the Atwood Foundation for supporting journalism in Alaska and for sponsoring my being here today. So thank you. I also want to thank the Atwood Foundation again for all that it has done for this community and for all that it continues to do, especially in my beloved field, journalism. It's an exciting and challenging time to be a journalist. It certainly is at APTI, where we are continuing to look at new ways to connect with our audiences with new programs and new reporting efforts on the web. Some of you might be aware that we are in talks right now with our fellow public broadcasters in Bethel and Fairbanks and Juneau and various communities in the southeast known as Coast Alaska. They represent the radio stations in K2 and Juneau about how to best move forward in this very challenging time and move forward together in the coming years. Among our top agenda items at APTI is how best to combine our four websites into one that features PBS, NPR, our local news and programs, and various community, civic, and media partners. And if we have time during the question and answer period, I hope I can answer some of the questions that might prompt. We want to build online what we feel like we've already built through the airwaves, a source for accurate and authentic reporting and engaging programs, and a community commons where groups such as this one, institutions such as UAA, and individuals can share ideas and talk about the important issues facing our community and our state. I mentioned that I was here about a year ago. Not a lot has changed in the media world since speaking with you last. Newspaper circulation is down. Advertising is down, way down. Magazines are having an even tougher time. TV viewership is down. Radio listenership, with the exception of one network, NPR, is soft. I would have brought some charts. I think Lisa asked if I wanted some ability to do any multimedia presentations, but all the arrows that I would have brought would have pointed one way, and that's down. The one bright spot is that the market value of some newspaper companies, such as McClatchy, which owns the Anchorage Daily News, is up. So if you were here for round one of my talk, I spoke about two worlds. One, the analog world, which is imploding, and the digital world, which is exploding. Just this week, Apple introduced the long-awaited iPad, and some of you may be one of the early adopters. Some 300,000 copies were sold in one day. And that was just the Wi-Fi version. The later version, the 3G version, is to be coming out later. And many analysts believe that sales will really take off when that model is available. I don't know how people in my field of journalism would characterize the iPad, but for years, we talked about the need, the desire, and the hope for a portable digital version of the newspaper. And perhaps the iPad will be it. Already there's been a flurry of downloading on for applications for the iPad. Sources indicated that as many as 250,000 books and 1 million apps were downloaded over the first weekend. 250,000 books, over 1 million apps over the first weekend. And as you would guess, some of the apps, well, let me think about the right word for this group. Kind of goofy. But some are popular and some are practical, such as the iWorks, which is really the main workhorse of the Apple company. And some were fascinating, at least to me. There's one called StarWalk. And apparently you take StarWalk after you've downloaded it on your iPad and you can point it up to the sky. And with an internal digital compass, it has the ability to identify what it recognizes in the sky. You tap on the object and it tells you a lot more about it. And there's another one that's interesting to me called Art Authority. And so for $9.99, you can download Art Authority, and at your fingertips are 40,000 works of art at your fingertips on the iPad. News organizations are getting into the act too. NPR, which I am proud to say is a news leader and an innovation leader, was among the first to begin promoting its app, and that's interesting to me too. The iPad is just another bold step in this journey that we're all on. Now, you'll note a few times I've said, interesting to me. I've done this for a purpose. And that's really the subject of, I hope, our conversation today, because I want it to be a conversation. Why do we watch what we watch? Why do we read what we read? And what are the implications as we make judgments about domestic and foreign policy, if this is the case, and about other civic matters? I've long thought that people sought information primarily for three reasons. Each reason had a lofty component, and one had a simpler one. Each had an admirable quality, and, well, one that was not so admirable. So in no particular order, they are: people want information that stretches their imaginations, that expands our knowledge base. We want enlightenment. We want to be invigored. And science is at the base of this, and science is this desire to grow, to expand, to learn more, you know? And at the low end, certainly for me, is the pursuit of baking the perfect chocolate chip cookie. There's another type of information that we seek, and it confirms what we believe to be true. So if you're a scientist, this is not a bad thing. In fact, it's a good thing, because you're looking for some data that backs up your claim or fact or proves it wrong. Imagine if we had stopped when we thought the world was flat. And there's probably not such a good thing if we only pursue information that we believe to be true. And the third is the type of information that's simply titillating. We just can't help it to know, want to know what's going on with our neighbors. We all slow down when there's an accident on the road. We want to know what happens. So perhaps we can come back to two of these reasons, rationales, at another time, but I want to share some thoughts about the second type I mentioned, and that's the type of information that simply reinforces what we believe to be true. That kind of information is very seductive. There's plenty of this on the internet. I've been thinking about what this means in this I want it, when I want it now world that we live in today. I stumbled across a piece by Elizabeth Colbert, who was writing in The New Yorker last fall, and she explored this phenomenon that was using the work done by a gentleman named Cass Sunstein, who was a former law professor at the University of Chicago, who's written extensively about what he calls virtual civics. So in this era of iPads and iPhones and Wi-Fi and YouTube and all the rest, we have the capability to engage with millions of ideas, and we also have the ability, and he says, proclivity to disengage as well. And while the most visited internet sites remain the leading news sites, at least for Americans, other options on the net and over the cable are growing daily. For instance, the Nielsen Company has reported that many viewers in D.C., at least, District of Columbia, are turning to Al Jazeera, Euronews, and China Central Television to get their dose of foreign news coverage. Of course, the BBC is still the most popular choice in D.C. for foreign coverage. But what do you think is second? Russia Today. It's a Kremlin-backed station that produces programs in English and in Spanish and in Arabic. In D.C., for those of you who've never been there, and for those of you who have, you'll recognize that it's not a bad place to see firsthand the growth and all the choices. One source reported, for instance, that the State Department says there are nearly 800 media outlets from 113 countries in Washington, D.C. So given this explosion, news consumers have millions of choices which they can gladly pursue. The latest Pew Center report, and if you're interested in this sort of thing, the Pew Center puts out a State of the News Media report every year. And on this year, they noted that the internet had overtaken national and local print newspapers as sources. And of course, many of those online sources are the digital versions of the print version, but people are still going to the internet instead. And a lot of the news or rumor can be found on the internet. The Pew report noted that only 7% of adults got their news from one source. So we are grazers. We jump from one source to the next source to the next in a matter of minutes. And we tend to graze in the same familiar pastures. The report that Ms. Colbert was referring to in the New Yorker last fall gave an insight into this. He studied 50 political websites, and what he found, according to Colbert, was 4/5 linked to like-minded sites. So people were going from the site they liked the best, then they went to another site that was just like the other site, which is like, if you've all been to Amazon and you've bought a book, you will know how it says, and others bought this book and bought this book and bought this book. Okay. So I guess what this would mean, depending on your point of view, is the dumb we're getting dumber or the smart we're getting smarter. She also took note of a 1970 college study in Michigan, which I thought was very fascinating, in which a group of students were divided into two groups, one with low prejudice, one with high, and this was about race. The students were told to discuss various political issues with racial overtones. So one group, high tolerance, one group, low tolerance. And the researchers found that after the students talked to others like themselves, what happened? The bigoted students had become more bigoted. The tolerant students had become more tolerant. She also noted this as group polarization had been supported by a number of other research studies. And Sustain argued in the piece that the internet was taking this concept to a new high level, which he called cyber polarization. So I agree with what some of you might be thinking. Hasn't this tendency to aggregate around those with like positions? It's really nothing new. Well, a good friend of mine, a professor of military history at Penn State University, Carol Reardon, has looked at this. And I may have mentioned this book in my previous talk. If I did, I apologize. But I think she has written about an extraordinary thing that goes on in writing history. And I brought it with me today. It's called Pickett's Charge in History and Memory by Carol Reardon. And what she did was she looked at the most covered battle in the history of the Civil War. There were more reporters at the Battle of Gettysburg than any other battle during the war. And they dutifully wrote down what they thought they saw and what they thought they heard. And these stories, these news stories, became the backbone later of the regimental histories that were done, of the troops who fought in those four very bloody days in Pennsylvania. And then those histories and those newspaper articles became the frameworks for many of the history books and papers that followed. So, well, Carol painstakingly, and when I say painstakingly, I mean that, she went back to Gettysburg numerous times and walked those fields, walked those places, climbed those trees, went into those ravines, read paper after paper, letter after letter. And what she found was that memory is a pretty faulty thing, and people tend to report what others are reporting that fits the convenient and influential narrative at the time. And I thought I would read just a very brief segment of what she means by this. As the individual memories of one small episode reveal, much of what history tells us is true about Pickett's charge may not rest on a strong foundation of fact. From the very start, in its efforts to answer questions about the formation of the attacking columns, the number of lines, who broke first, who advanced farthest, who stayed the longest, who fell back fighting, history has competed with, been obscured by, even attacked by memory. Every narrative of Pickett's charge we read today includes this subtle subtext. And the student of history must be wary of memory's introduction of the fog of war. Myth and history intertwine freely on those fields, and some of their tendrils always will defy untangling. Well, in short, people say what other people are saying. Some of you are familiar with Senator Hiram Johnson. He was a Republican senator at the turn of the last century, isolationist, and about the time of World War I said, the first casualty when war comes is truth. So lay this phenomenon of group polarization over any subject you want. In our case, it might be foreign affairs, politics, public policy. Do we read the New York Times or the Washington Times because we believe it supports our point of view? Do we watch Fox or MSNBC because we want information about news that challenges our assumptions or reinforces them, and so forth? Anyone with an open source content management system is free to report whatever is popping into his or her head, and they do. We at APTI, however, and by extension PBS and NPR, have chosen to stick with a pretty traditional, and some might say out of date, point of view. Our reports will be accurate, they'll be authentic, they'll be balanced, and they'll be fair. And so when you come to our door and we say, we're so glad to see you, we'll mean it. Thank you.
Is there any secret to knowing if a website is really valid when you start looking up some of the media? I mean, how do you know? I've read, you know, what they say they are.
There's really not. I think one of the good things that is happening, I say good things, it might be more of a comforting things, is that most people tend to go to the reputable news sites. Now, you can debate their politics, and some of the things that might be said on their editorial pages cause you some personal heartburn. But for the most part, most people are still going to the very traditional sites. So what poses the challenge from an institutional, if not a business perspective, is that journalism seems to be alive and well, at least journalism as I grew up to understand it and appreciate it. What's dying is the life form that it took. And so many, many newspapers, television stations, and it's certainly the case in public broadcasting, where it's constantly a challenge. But there's really not the ability to discern the accuracy, the authenticity of the group. Some of them appreciate the transparency and go about their business in a very transparent kind of way. It doesn't take you very long to know where their point of view is.
how did you decide to become a journalist? And when you decided to do that, who did you aspire to be like, and did you achieve it?
That's great. Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Well, I grew up the son of a high school dropout from Northern Illinois who met his wife-to-be and my mother at a dance in World War II. And like things happen, you know, and they got married after a couple of weeks. And my mother was the polar opposite. She was from Southern Arkansas, a Southern Baptist, never been in a steel mill in her life. So I grew up in these very black and white worlds. And I went to church with my mom. I went to mass with my dad. And so as part of this discovery process about my parents, because we would dutifully come home, and back then we would oftentimes in Little Rock where I grew up, we'd go to the drugstore and we'd have a tuna sandwich and a milkshake after church and we'd talk about things. And I would listen to my parents talk about the world. Anyway, I'll cut the story short. In reading a Newsweek or a Time magazine piece, I was reading about the Second Vatican Council. And in the piece, it made a very oblique reference to one of the two participants of the First Vatican Council who had essentially voted no on the question of papal infallibility. And that person had come from Little Rock, of all places. And I was struck by that. And I said, you know, that's kind of an interesting question. And I think what I will do is I will study religion and theology and maybe go to work for something like Commonweal or Christianity Today or one of the big, at the time, religious publications, because I was fascinated by those topics. I don't have a minor in religion, but fairly close, and I appreciated it. And SMU, where I went to school, has a very good divinity school there on campus and a very strong religion department. And I was in school at a time where it was very exciting to be a journalist. This is the early 70s, and all kinds of things are happening in Vietnam and in Washington, D.C. And so I had a very lofty reason, which was to write for one of these religious publications. And the other part, which is the second part, which is I find probably the more humorous part, was that I was at a party, and a gentleman came in, and this was a time where hair for men was far longer than it is today, much more like Lisa's is, and this fellow came in, and with a big Fu Manchu mustache and an adult beverage in one hand, and a very attractive woman in the other. And I said, I don't know what he does, but that's kind of maybe what I would like to do. So it sort of married both my intellectual interests and what I thought at the time was a good time. And it has been. I've had a wonderful time being a journalist and enjoyed every moment of it. But I can't say that I always wanted to be a writer, which is the case with many of my colleagues, or that I even thought of myself as a writer, which is the case with many of my colleagues. It's a great question. I get asked that in other places. And the gentleman is named Dave McNeely. Dave is one of the best known newspaper reporters and columnists in Texas. And he still lives in Texas and still writes. Texas was an exciting time. Texas Monthly was just being created. Molly Ivins was writing for the Texas Observer. There were two Dallas papers. There were two Houston papers. It was an exciting time to be in journalism.
On an area that you may have more expertise than most, how is public radio doing nationally competitively vis-a-vis commercial stations? I thought you alluded to this market, but nationally, how's it doing?
It's doing flat, which is great. That's on the audio, what we call the audio side. If you look at the reception to NPR on the online side of the house, the arrow is going almost straight up. And it's thanks in part to the innovation that they're displaying with things like the NPR app, which you can, you know, get to your favorite NPR station, you know, around the country. Now, that's threatening in many respects if you think about the world in a strictly analog world. I don't find it threatening. I find it challenging to figure out how to, you know, tap into that change. But NPR is one of the most innovative news organizations, not just in the country, but in the world. And that's being displayed on their websites. And what they're finding is that not only is news and information being challenged by multiple sources, it's no longer just consumed the way it was. News and information is now a social engagement experience, so that you read a story, you watch a story, you listen to a story, and then you share it. And NPR was really quick to figure that out, and as a result of it, the website is a very high-trafficked website.
Can I follow up with one question? Why have you increased your BBC content so much, and is BBC picking up any significant amount of NPR broadcasting?
There's two questions there. First of all, we try to be good business people, and so we listen to our customers. A lot of our customers said they wanted to have more BBC coverage, so we have the BBC World and other programs on KSKA. We're also in the very early stages of working with NPR and other stations, or looking at other stations, to better integrate NPR national coverage and BBC international coverage in our local site. And a number of stations around the country have started to do that very successfully. So one, we've been listening. I don't know the interplay, frankly, between the BBC and the NPR, whether BBC picks up NPR program or not.
Pat, thanks for your talk. I was wondering, first, can you explain what's happening with the news media in Alaska between the NPR sites, the print newspapers, the two or three web newspapers that are web only? And one question I have is, it used to be, while we had a very competitive news market, the Associated Press would kind of collect everything and redistribute everything, so that there was at least, you were pretty much counting on getting every story in any news medium you turned to. And now you don't. I mean, I'm not sure if the AP picks up any of the stuff that, say, the Dispatch does.
Yeah.
And that leads to the second question, which is, what is the newspaper of record concept these days? Because, if you want to find out what was going on in 2010, has most of it going to disappear into the vapor, or what's happening there?
Yeah, great questions. All of which are great subjects to come back to sometime. On the local scene, I don't know that it's that much different here than it is in most other states. There might be a few places where this is not happening, but most states have lost staff and lost paper, which are the two fundamental ingredients or costs to, you know, running a newspaper. That translates to anywhere between 80 and 90% of what a newspaper's expense items are. And you'll notice with the ADN and other papers around the state and there are other papers around the country, both paper and people have started to disappear. I've noticed in the ADN, for instance, the past couple of weeks, they've started to return to some Matsu coverage, or at least packaging it that way. When I first came, they had a separate section. And as I've said before, I have walked in Pat Doherty's shoes. I have experienced the pain of having to make pretty severe cuts in coverage and in people and newsprint and everything else. I don't know that's not a trend that we won't see continue to happen, whether it's here or around the state. I think you'll see some changes in news design. There might be an attempt to move back to more tabloids, which are sometimes more confusing to read but easier to produce if you have the right type of production equipment. The second question, which you asked about the paper record, I think is an excellent one. If you look at the names of newspapers, traditionally and historically, they typically had three types of names. One signified their politics. They were the Democrat. They were the Republican, etc. Some carried names that talked about the pride in technology that they had, like the Telegraph, the Dispatch, and so forth. The paper that I worked for in Eugene was the combination of the Register and the Guard, which are really interesting papers in their own right. And we dutifully tried to maintain the record part of what was going on in the in Eugene and Lane County, where the paper was mainly distributed. It's a great question. I'm not sure that there. I don't know that there is a paper that can claim that it's the paper of record anymore because it doesn't have the people or the paper to do it. Now, in the digital world, you don't have to worry about the paper. You still have to worry about the people. And one of the things that we are going to start to move ahead with at APTI is to try to figure out what's the right combination of reporting that we can do with a professional, and I don't say that in a pejorative way, but people that have come through to be professionally trained, and citizen journalists. What are the stories that citizens can tell that are accurate and fair and are worth sharing with people? We will be looking at how some civic groups and organizations have stories that they can share and that they can tell to expand the contributions that we make and that others can make. But it's a really good question. There are a lot of debates that go on in newspaper and professional journalism circles about the question of the record. What's the record? Because it implies this notion that there's a gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper is the one mainly responsible for the wholeness of the story, the balance of the story, the fairness of the story. I spend a lot of time with my students at UAA taking stories and putting them up and dissecting them and looking at where the holes, not just where the holes journalistically are, but where are the holes in balance and fairness. How much opportunity do you give the other side? Where is the other side's voice captured in the piece? And that's something that I spend a lot of time with because I want them to understand that what separates, at least in my mind, journalism from other things are values and principles. And irrespective of how those get displayed, whether it's in a newspaper or radio or on the internet, you can still carry with you a value. The value of the record, this is the record, I think is going to be a tough one to capture in this cycle of news that we live in now. It's a great question. I'd like to come back and talk about that more in depth. Oh, hi. For a minute there, I thought you were going to let one of the Norwegians ask the question, and then I was not brushed up for that today.
Well, thanks for coming. I've been doing an internship in a U.S. Senate office for the last few months, and one of the themes that keeps coming up to me is that people really listen to the news and go to the internet and watch the TV to find out what their government is doing. But one of the problems with that is that I notice that journalists don't often report more sources for people to go look up legislation and read for themselves what's actually going on. As you're teaching a new generation of journalists, is there anything that you're doing to help them utilize new sources of information like the Library of Congress's website, Thomas, which prints legislation on the internet for free? Is there anything you can be doing to facilitate that knowledge base and encourage young journalists to get information out to constituents so that they don't get so confused and they don't know where to look for more information?
We do some of that. And we try to collect great sources during the course of the year, particularly in the when I was in school would have been called the basic reporting class at UAA. It's called information gathering, which is about sources and how to get additional sources and how to probe, keep probing, keep asking questions. And that's a great recommendation.
You mentioned that most people go to the same websites and they visit the same news sources. And they sort of stay in their own pasture. What websites do you visit? What news sources?
Well, you know, I play around. I think I mentioned the last time I was here. For different reasons, I go to different places. As sort of an armchair genealogist, I'm helping a friend of mine whose dad was in the invasion of first Sicily and then Italy. And so I am spelunking. I'm all over the place looking for little bits and pieces of information because like a lot of men and women, records were burned in a fire in St. Louis. His dad's records were lost in the fire as well. So I spend a lot of my, you know, idle time on you know, doing that kind of thing. I am a self-confessed sports junkie. I love sports and I love professional football, and this is about, as ESPN says, you know, 18 days 44 hours, 32 seconds, you know, till draft day. And so I'm reading everything I can about the draft. I scan like most people do, where I scan are places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Atlanta Constitution, where I was from, you know, spent quite a few years. But then I'll start getting off into a bent. I worked for a very brief period of time in Manchester. And I'm a closeted Man U fan, so I will go and read what I can about, you know, what's happening with Man U, and it's arch rival City, and the way to do that's go to, you know, to British papers. So I'm kind of all over the map. I don't know that I would be necessarily a great example of it, but in news I tend to go to the Times, the Wall Street Journal, CNN. And NPR, I have stuff that's emailed to me, and I have RSS feeds that come to me.
Well, I'm very glad you came. And I wanted to second this word, the idea of proclivity to disengage. And my topic is television, because my husband and I have not watched television for about 10 years, and we don't miss it.
Which you'd miss PBS.
Sorry about that. But I did read, occasionally read articles in magazines. Most of what I read is on the web. But the last time I read an article in the National Geographic, I felt like I had been shorted. And I'd liked your opinion of what I consider the dumbing down of articles. The articles are shorter, they don't cover the ideas, and that's a lot of the reason why we turned the TV off.
Well, articles have gotten shorter because our attention spans have gotten shorter. That's a stereotype, but I think it is collectively true. We're all multitaskers with abilities to communicate. Good or bad, we're rearing children that are even better or worse at it than we are. I don't know how my son can look at a computer, watch TV, and text, and he does it fairly comfortably, at least he says that he does. I worry, I'll come back to that in a second. The issue of television, I think that's a market. That's the freedom of a market. And you can watch what you want to watch, now you can watch it when you want to watch it. Because PBS and others, you can watch shows through your television set. Hulu and YouTube have become networks in and of their own rights. And you can watch a lot of programming, that's entertaining or news-wise, you know, there. But that's the market. So, I don't see necessarily an end to that. I think there's an economy to it all. There can only be so many stations because of economics. But I grew up, as many of you did, with the television. I was thinking about cultural icons the other day, when Fess Parker died the other day. It struck a lot of men of my generation in a real soft spot, because we grew up watching Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier, and we'd gather around, you know, the grandmother's television on a Sunday night and watch, you know, Wonderful World of Color. And you had two stations, you had three stations. You know, that one of the most popular shows in our most recent PBS pledge drive was the old Ed Sullivan 60s shows. We had the Beatles and the Stones and all those on. Hey, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.